The Late Debate on RTE Radio 1.
Is there a black and white case for Boris Johnson's resignation in the Grey Report? A crisis of confidence or same as it ever was? Why do half of Irish people say they distrust the government? And the carrot of hefty subventions or the stick of punitive taxes? What works to get much needed housing built? We'll have all that and more on tonight's Late Debate. It's Colm O'Mungoyne in for Katie this week, and joining me in studio tonight are Paul McAuliffe, Fianna Fáil TD for Dublin North West and party spokesperson on local government, Matty McGrath, Independent TD for Tipperary, Gary Gannon, Social Democrats TD for Dublin Central and party spokesperson on education, higher education, arts, social protection, foreign affairs and defence. That's quite the nameplate. And Jennifer Bray, political correspondent with the Irish Times. And on a day when Passport Express was rebranded post-passport, despite 195,000 applicants still being very much pre-passport, what great Irish institution would you rebrand and what would you call it? The best suggestion wins a Late Debate mug from us tonight. We want to hear from you on that and anything else you hear on the programme, so please do get in touch. You can text us on 51551 or email us on latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebaterte. But first, police fines, and now the Sue Gray report with findings its author says will dismay the public. Despite accounts of vomiting, fighting and aides insulting Downing Street staff in his house, Boris Johnson believes the case for him to remain in post as Prime Minister is overwhelming. He was in penitent mode earlier today.
I want to start by saying that I'm humbled by what has happened, and I renew my wholehearted apology for the gathering in the Cabinet Room on the 19th of June 2020, my birthday, for which I received a fixed penalty notice. Now that Sue Gray has completed her inquiry and everyone can read her report, I want, in all humility and without mitigating what has happened, to offer a few points of context. And I was in particular appalled to learn that there have been multiple examples, in Sue Gray's phrase, of disrespectful and poor treatment of cleaning and security personnel. And this afternoon, I personally apologised to those dedicated members of staff for what happened, and I expect anyone who behaved in that way to do the same. As Sue Gray acknowledges, I have acted on her recommendations to make a series of changes.
John Rentoul, Chief Political Commentator with the London Independent, is on the line. John Rentoul, thanks very much for joining us this evening.
Hi there.
Boris Johnson went in front of backbenchers in the 1922 committee this evening, so if one had one's ear to the door, what one would one have heard? A claim or opprobrium?
Well, a bit of both, as always. But the Conservative Parliamentary Party is deeply divided. Fortunately, these private meetings of Tory MPs are not that private, because a lot of Tory MPs come out of them almost straight away and tell journalists what the Prime Minister has just said.
So what are they saying?
Yeah, well, one or two of them were horrified by the Prime Minister making jokes about tractors, a reference to the porn-watching MP who's caused a by-election in Devon. Sorry, I've got a sore throat from talking so much today, but others were more supportive of the Prime Minister and think that he's through the worst of it.
And will Boris Johnson said that he was keen to lay out the context there. MPs returning to their constituencies this weekend, will context cut it with the British public?
No, but the British public's view is pretty well known already, well established. I mean, the fact that the police have fined the Prime Minister is pretty unavoidable, and so there's no question that that the rules were broken, contrary to the Prime Minister's assurances when the story first broke. So the British public have taken a pretty dim view of all that. But there's nothing really striking in the Sue Gray report that is that's going to make things worse for him.
And there's nothing there that would lend further weight to the arguments that he misled Parliament, is there? Nothing obvious.
On the contrary, there's nothing in there that would substantiate that. What I was looking for in the Sue Gray report was evidence that the Prime Minister was told specifically that an event should not go ahead because it would be contrary to the guidelines or to the law. And Sue Gray says explicitly that there is no evidence that that happened. And so the Prime Minister can say, hand on heart, when the Committee of Privileges inquires into this, he can say, you know, I believed it to be true when I said I thought the rules had been followed because, to be fair to him, the rules were not very clear. I mean, the rules which he'd drawn up himself. And the fact that people have been fined since does not necessarily mean that he should have known that the rules were being broken.
Unlike yourself, who suffering from a dry throat, Keir Starmer, the Labour leader, photos recently came out of him having a beer in hand. So does Keir's beer take the sting out of some of Labour's outrage, or at least the effectiveness of it?
Well, it has done in the past couple of weeks. Labour have shut up about lockdown law breaking. But Keir Starmer had a good day today. I mean, he came across as relaxed and prime ministerial in the House of Commons, asking the Prime Minister questions about the cost of living and then responding to the statement on Sue Gray's report, where he just made the very simple point that he has said that he would resign if he got a penalty notice. And allowing people to draw their own conclusions, because everybody knows the Prime Minister is not going to resign, having had a notice himself.
Well, the sting was taken out of the report somewhat in advance because it was heavily trailed that the Met wasn't going to issue any further fines to Boris Johnson. Has that raised any eyebrows? Because in the recent past, the Met hasn't covered itself with glory. So allowing that information to come into the public domain in advance and for it to be used in that way, has that gotten the Met into any more bother, or have people largely just awaited the findings of this report?
Oh, no. The whole point was that this report would only be published when the Met said that they'd finished their inquiries. But you are quite right that when the Met announced that they'd completed their investigations, there was quite a lot of head-scratching going on, that the Prime Minister had only had one penalty notice. And now that we have, from Sue Gray, a more detailed account of some of these gatherings that happened, and the Prime Minister was at several of them, there is puzzlement as to how he could have avoided more penalty notices. And particularly, there are questions about why some people got penalty notices and other people didn't. I mean, Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, turned up early for a meeting and ended up being ambushed with a cape for the Prime Minister's birthday and getting a penalty notice. Simon Case, the Cabinet Secretary, who was also there, because he's in the photos that have been published today, didn't get a penalty notice. And so there are quite a lot of demands on the Labour side for the Metropolitan Police to explain themselves.
All right. Well, John Rountoul, thanks very much. We'll let you away to treat the sore throat for a well-earned glass of water or whatever else. Unfortunately, not from a late debate mug, which will be going to one of our listeners later on this evening. Thanks for that. We have two texts in. Well done to the UK for holding MPs to account on their boozy parties compared to Ireland's shambles in their handling of the elites breaking lockdown laws over Partygate. And contrast Boris Johnson's, another separate text, contrast Boris Johnson's behaviour with the approach of Micheál Martin. We should appreciate having a safe pair of hands in charge here. Jennifer Bray, Boris Johnson's not the only person leading a government with a crisis of confidence at the moment. According to what you were reporting on today, people are disinclined to believe the government here. Well, tell us about who commissioned the report and what it found.
Yeah, so this was a report which was commissioned by UCD, and what it effectively found was that almost 50% of people do not trust the government, and that a majority of people, more than 50% of people, do not believe that the government is communicating information that is either accurate or unbiased. We kind of trail behind other European countries when it comes to how we feel about the government, although we are behind the UK and we are also behind Poland. One of the interesting things about the study was that despite the fact that those 2,000 respondents in Ireland felt this way about the government, they felt very strong levels of trust towards the European Union. So it would appear that we trust the EU more than we trust our own government. it is understandable, I think, that in the UK, those levels of trust are much lower even than ourselves. I think even you see how British politics is playing out, and when you heard what we just heard, you know, Boris Johnson not resigning despite some of the incredible details we've heard. I mean, I think if those things happened here in Ireland amongst any of our ministers or civil servants, there would be absolute outrage. I mean, we saw what happened in that your texter mentioned that party there, which lasted 1 minute, exactly 1 minute in the Department of Foreign Affairs after the Security Council vote. But the other thing I would say about that trust survey is every survey of this kind that has been done for the last 10 years has shown really high levels of distrust. This one to me actually seems a little bit lower. And I wonder,
things are getting better, are they?
Yes, after the recession in particular and after the Troika came in, there was sky high levels of distrust. And you could totally understand why. And I wonder, is any of that to do with the handling of the pandemic? Do people feel that the government did take their best interests at heart, despite the fact that the levels are still very, very high? And you'd have to wonder about the long-term impact of that lack of trust when you have these big issues like climate change to tackle.
Well, one of the issues was that people had a high level of trust in scientists, and that would play into your analysis there, that the likes of Neffet perhaps did get a large amount of public support or public trust during the pandemic crisis.
Yeah, only 12% of people expressed a negative emotion about scientists working in a capacity with the government. That is a really, really low figure. And it shows you the people, and we've seen, you know, studies and opinion polls throughout the pandemic crisis, which, you know, pitched Leo Varadkar up against Tony Holohan, in which Tony Holohan came out on top on most of those surveys. So I think people did trust scientists, and they do trust scientists over politicians.
Right.
And the media, by the way.
Right. Well, just very quickly, what did they say about the media?
I think it was 32% of people are in and around expressed negative views about social media. And it was, I can't remember the exact statistic for newspapers and media, but it was similar levels of distrust. Not the worst figures I've ever heard. Nothing to get overly depressed about, but something to think about.
All right, Gary, they love scientists, not so much and on politics Democrats and the media. are you surprised by the findings and from Jennifer's report today?
No, not really, actually, in terms of, if you take the fact that we live in a democracy and a representative democracy, people are inevitably going to think if the people they support are in government, we'll trust them. If they're in opposition, we trust them. Look, cynicism does exist in politics. I think particularly during the period of the recession, it wasn't just the fact that the Troika was here. I think promises were made by politicians standing in front of, we won't raise student fees signs, for example, and then that happened, or every little whore Tesco ads, and then every single policy on that was initiated. And that engenders a bit of cynicism.
No particular target in mind there with those two examples. No,
I didn't name them.
No, that's fine.
Don't labour the point, Gary.
No. But look, I think the idea of people not having trust in politicians is an age-old phenomenon. It's our job actually to communicate better, to say true to our words. People like myself, who came through on kind of a wave of post-recessionary politics, have an obligation to actually learn lessons from the past. So the fact that people don't trust politics reflects on the fact that actually some people feel that politics doesn't work for them. If you are somebody who's experiencing the housing crisis, you're not going to feel politicians have your back at the moment, and that's just the reality of it.
Matty, you've been both a government TD and an independent TD in opposition. Where's life nicer in terms of the public reaction?
Well, we have a duty to represent our electorate, and as Gary just said, the amount of people that turn out to vote, you know, in some constituencies is quite scary, but people haven't been represented. Take people into housing for 20 years, 12 years, you know, the homeless. We've had more housing ministers than we've had nearly houses built at this stage in the last 10 years. And promises have been made, including made by the President Taoiseach, that they'd handle the housing crisis. It's not been handled.
And when you were a government TD, did people believe you more or less than believe you now?
When I was a government TD, it was in 2007 I got in. The first year or year and a half were fine, but then the Celtic Tiger fled or was assassinated or whatever. But the distrust really started there, because the banks were left running amok. We bailed them out. And it was up my vote, which I regret to this day. And people have a huge distrust when you see what's happening now. Banks are fleeing the country. People aren't getting their fair settlement from the banks that were found to be whatever, boozing their tracker rates or whatever. So there hasn't been a fair treatment of the public.
Right.
And whether it be bankers, whether it be cocoa funds or whatever, they seem to get preferential treatment. Why wouldn't the people be disenchanted?
We were going to get into housing later on. Yeah. 15 years of TD yesterday.
Yes, I was actually. I didn't realise until my daughter texted me. So
there you go. A life sentence in some courts.
Well, it's nothing compared to the fellow in the house that we found in the question last night. I'm only taking baby steps compared to some of the members. But I think that we'll never see those 40 years. And I'm saying, personally, I'm saying, in general, we won't see those again, I think. There's 40 years of service from TDs. I can't imagine if we would.
Never say never.
Never say never.
Paul McAuliffe, according to that report, every second house disbelieves you as a government TD.
Yeah, and every other one supports us, certainly supported the government when it was elected in 2020. And by and large, I think Gary makes a valid point. I suppose if you support a particular political party or a coalition of parties, then you're more likely to support them. What's interesting listening to what's coming from London, and I suppose in a way, Sue Gray, we got the recommendations first and then we had to wait for the gory details. And when you read them, they really are kind of quite shocking. Overflowing bins, wines on wall, you know, security guards breaking up parties. I know there were one or two incidents here in different forms, some with political people, some with civil servants. Nothing like what we're reading in Sue Gray. And I think your texter is correct. I don't think you can imagine Micheál Martin acting or standing over what Boris Johnson has stood over. You know, sometimes in the world of social media, likes and TikTok and all the rest, that doesn't come across in terms of popularity. But I think there's a decency about Micheál that I think has stood by him during the pandemic. And I think that's a broad, and I'm not making a party with Linda, there is
just comparatively speaking to Boris Johnson, is it? Yeah.
That was a question about cynicism.
But I'm saying there was a broad support. And actually,
okay, all right,
you see it here in terms of scientists.
No, you've very effectively made your point at that stage. Maddie mentioned housing there. Let's get on to it's never far from being the main event in politics there, and housing was the main source of contention in the Dáil today. Let's hear some of the debate that was going on.
Your narrative is, on every issue, is to oppose, and say that it's not working. We've had the highest amount of commencements in the year to March this year than we've seen since 2007. We've had the highest amount of first-time buyer mortgages in the year to March this year in the 12 months than we've seen since 2007 also. And we will support people in owning their own homes because we believe in home ownership. And whilst we're doing that, Deputy, we're also delivering more social homes this year than has ever been seen before in any year since the foundation of the state. And we're doing that even though you and your colleagues right across the 26 counties continue to object, delay.
That's Housing Minister Dara O'Brien there, who was speaking in answer to Piers Doherty, who was also speaking in the same debate.
What planet are you living on? Which families and workers out there, ordinary people, can afford that amount of money? And who do you write the cheque to? You write it to the developers, €144,000, straight out of the playbook of Fianna Fáil, right back in the times of the Galway tent. We know who your plans are working for, but they're not working for ordinary families and workers. They're not working for renters.
A lot of numbers there, Jennifer. What was all that about? What was the point at issue?
Right, this is a weekly thing, the government versus Sinn Féin on housing, and rightly so. And, you know, you'd be glad to hear it in a way. Today, what the debate...
Conversations with friends.
Conversations not with friends, conversations very much with enemies. But today's debate zoned in, for want of a better phrase, on this Croí Cónaithe Fund. This is effectively a plan to subvent the construction of 5,000 apartments in Dublin, Cork, Limerick, Galway and Waterford. And what Sinn Féin are saying is that this is Fianna Fáil going back to the old days of throwing money after developers. And what Fianna Fáil and the government are saying is actually these are 5,000 apartments that won't be built because it's not financially feasible or doable for those developers. And they are bridging that gap. And they say they put in place a number of different kind of conditions around it, such as, you know, it has to be one apartment per person, it has to be four blocks, has to be 40 apartments per block, and it can't be sold within 10 years or else you have to pay a certain amount of tax on it. I mean, the debate itself kind of goes round and round really every week. The government says that the proof is in the pudding. If you look at the commencement numbers of houses, that they're on the rise. And Sinn Féin actually had a very striking line today where they say that the housing policies of Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil are defining life now for a generation of people in that they're locked out of home ownership.
Right. Paul McCall, of €450 million to developers. If this was going to deliver affordable units to people, people might like it better. But is it? I mean, the figures that were talked about in the debate today was not 250,000 per apartment, but Piers Doherty cited figures of 350,000 to 390,000. That's beyond the reach of an awful lot of people with the mortgage borrowing limits that are in place at the moment.
It is. I suppose what Sinn Féin continues to do, and they've done it with the shared equity scheme as well, is they continue to focus on parts of Housing for All that they believe they can paint us as being in the Galway tent with the developers. And what they continuously ignore, and you talk about 450 million, they continuously ignore the 20 billion that's going into housing. And that's around council-led affordable housing, that's the council building affordable homes themselves, and that's around cost rental, which is lifetime rental agreements below the cost, and our social housing.
But it's the job of the opposition to scrutinise every line of the 20 billion you're talking about. And on that 450 million... it's been offered as an incentive for developers to get these buildings done. It seems an awful lot of money. Is it effectively a subvention or a tax break by any other name?
I'm happy to defend Croí Chonaill, and I'll do that in a moment. My point is that it is a very small fraction of the overall public housing programme that we're doing, and that includes the Land Development Agency and others. On Croí Chonaill, what these are is they're effectively below-cost, owner-occupied apartments. Now,
below-cost to whom?
Below the cost of construction.
And will the consumer ultimately see below cost prices when it comes to buying?
Of course they are.
The current market rates that are out of most people's reach.
That is the ultimate difficult question. At the Housing Committee yesterday, we discussed the cost of construction. But what the government is doing, both in local authorities and with Croí Chonaill, don't forget, at local authority level, we're also giving €100,000 to local authorities to provide affordable housing as well. These are below the cost of construction. In a debate where only 6 or 7 months ago we were saying there wasn't affordable owner-occupied, to make the point, owner-occupied apartments we are incentivising.
But what does that translate into in terms of a house price or an apartment price to people who want to buy them? What's the lowest price people will be able to buy them for? Just give us a hard figure, because you have had a good run. What's the lowest price that you can...
I can't give you a price on a mythical site, Colin. It's impossible.
Well, what's the target?
But the target is that we will subvent the cost of construction. Matthew's doing it again. We're going to subvent the cost of construction to the tune of 100,000 with an open book accounting process so that those sites that otherwise would not be built will now be built below the cost of construction.
With no price in mind to the consumer, though, in terms of what they will have to pay.
Of course, we're subventing the price by €100,000. Of course, that's
well, it's not guaranteed it'll be passed on, is it?
There's an open book accounting process. Part of an expression of interest process. This is public money. We're not about to throw public money into the bin here.
All right, carry on. Great kind of agreement that suggests that when the developers get this money up to €144,000 per apartment, that they pass the price of that on today, that they give that back to the consumer. There's nothing locked in there. This is illogical in many ways. And I should say, and I'm going to just pivot very briefly, it was actually the Social Democrats that brought this motion to the Dáil last week in relation to the 450 million. And this generated a conversation. And what we've seen in the Dáil today, and I was watching the Leaders' Debate as part of the RTE Leaders segment, I see a Westminsterisation of our politics, where every week Sinn Féin and Fianna Fáil suits them both to come in there and almost like tackle back and forward. And it's not even almost about the issue. It's about scoring little points against each other, getting the best soundbite in. And we don't actually delve deeply into the issues. Now, the issue at hand here in relation to this 450 million, we've asked 3 questions in the Social Democrats to Dara O'Brien over the last 2 weeks of raising this. And I would like to get an answer to them now. It's, what was the independent analysis of Croí Chonaill before, and who was in the room when this was developed? We would suggest, and it's hard not to believe, that this is a developer-led proposal. I would like that to be disproven. Then the second question was, where's the international precedent that suggests that when we give developers this level of money without locking in anything, that the price must be passed on to the consumer? Is there international precedent for this? There isn't. And then the third question is the developer still guaranteed a profit of 15% on top of the 144,000, or is that the 15% still locked in?
All right,
no answers. And Piers Starty didn't ask those questions today. It was just shouting back and forward.
All right, Matty, you wanted to come in on this.
Yes, I too had a question, a needed question today, and I asked the housing, but Gary's right. There's no mention of that. It's the same two parties. They seem to be playing a game here, but it's not a game for many people. I want to declare I was never in a Galloway tent and I wasn't seeing the fallout, right? But this is a developer's package. Nothing short of it. I can't believe it's quite bonkers for Fianna Fáil to go back to this area again. They got enough of collateral damage before and it's not going to drop the price for any one person. And well, what we're talking about here.
If it gets houses built, does it take the pressure off the market
as a
whole?
No, because the 2D, who's going to build it for them? This is the problem. We have 9 or 10 properties in the whole county of Tipperary available for rent at the moment. It's a massive county, 150,000 people. They're not there. We're all spinning spin doctors and telling us this is going to happen. I'm sick and tired of housing reports. I mean, you could build houses with them. The amount of reports and Cree Corner, I call it Cree Brishta and Anna Brishta or Fod, that's what it is. And the people out there are so angry. And I never saw the housing crisis as bad. I'm in politics since 1990, but elected. I never saw it as bad at the moment. And people are in despair. The HAP system is just gobbling up billions of money and it's not delivering any local authority houses. And we're at a crisis point now. And I mean, the minister's coming to Tipperary tomorrow. I look forward to giving him a special Tipperary welcome. He'll get that. But I know he'll get that. And we want to know what he's delivering for Tipperary because it's not right. Happening.
And just to clarify on that, no cap will be put on how much profit a developer can make per unit.
All right.
But the Department of Housing says it'll form part of the assessment and that a margin of 15% will be normal.
All right, Paul McAuliffe. But what was, in answer to some of those questions, who designed this policy and how much developer input was there?
It's designed by the Department of Housing. As I say, it's an...
With input from whom?
Well, I suppose I wasn't privy to its development of the department, so I can't comment on that.
But
the alternative to the state coming in here is either A, that they're not built, okay, or B, the other alternative is that they are built and that they are available to vulture funds to purchase for buy-to-let. Now, we want to prioritise home ownership. This is one of the mechanisms. And Matty's wrong. It's not housing reports doing nothing. I can start to look at sites in Shangan, in Coltry, in Kildonan, in Oscar Traynor. These are all affordable purchase sites that are being constructed by local authorities and AHBs.
Why is the list growing? Growing.
Matty, I don't know if you know, but it takes time to build housing.
And a
government that is in office 2 years has made a substantial change. We pivoted away from
this
the market.
This government are in office 10
pivoted
years.
Pivoted away from the market, which is previous government.
You're part of the next government. Don't be telling us that story. People don't believe you.
I think there are other issues here.
It's not about believing us, Matty. It's about delivering for people.
I'll bring you in a second on this, because you mentioned vacant properties, Matty. And so, Jennifer, 450 million is the carrot. Is there room for a bit more stick in terms of the report that was brought out by the Housing Committee yesterday? Vacant properties was a significant area of concern. First of all, how many of them are there? And second of all, what's the best way of getting them back into use?
That's the question. Nobody knows exactly how many vacant properties there are long-term actually available. The committee actually had an architect in who gave evidence that probably there could be anywhere in around 137,000 actually available vacant properties. And I suppose the argument is, from what I pick up on in the Department of Housing, there's very much a push to bring in a vacant property tax and that Dara Bryan very much wants to proceed with that. I do hear that there is pushback in the Department of Finance, and the reason why is because they have been engaging with Revenue, who will shortly be giving them official figures of exactly how many vacant properties there are. It seems to me the soundings they're getting is that there are not very many at all, and that their thought process would be, why would we bring in place this punitive tax when there are very few properties that this would apply to? I think at the end of the day, it will be part of the budgetary package. It'll be a small part of it. There's also the vacant sites levy that's going to be reformed. But one of the things that stuck out for me in the report is that there is no one unit in the Department of Housing, you know, who are organising this and looking at this with joined up thinking. And I found that incredible, because this has been a problem we've talked about for a decade at least.
Are you hearing any of that, Paul McAuliffe, the issue of resistance from the Department of Finance?
Well, look, as Vice Chair of the Committee, I welcomed the publication yesterday. And I think it's not just about supply, it's also about tackling dereliction in the heart of many villages, which eats away at communities. So regardless of how much supply, vacant home tax will help end dereliction, and that's a benefit in and of itself. I was disappointed to see some murmurings last week. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that was coming at a political level from the minister.
Define murmurings.
It was very clear that there was efforts to try and undermine the idea of a vacant home tax. Both myself and Fianna Fáil are committed to that. It's important, as I say, for dereliction, but also to increase supply. And I would be disappointed if there's any movement from that. It was agreed in last year's budget to have a data collection process and then to introduce the tax. And
Gary, your constituency is no stranger to vacant properties. I think people would be aghast at some of the sites that are seen in the city centre and buildings that have fallen into derelictions. I don't know whether you got a chance to read the report yesterday,
but I have actually asked the Taoiseach during promise legislation session last week whether the government was still committed to the idea of a vacant home tax, as was first agreed with Fine Gael, I believe, 8 years ago. And I have to be honest, Paul, while I agree with every sentence you just uttered there, the Taoiseach was non-committal in terms of his commitment to a vacant property tax. He said there's a research ongoing and they'll discuss it and there'll be a decision forthcoming. But there was no commitment to it. My colleague Cian O'Callaghan asked him the very same question the day previously and there was no commitment to it. I think we can agree as people who are in Dublin City Council together, we need a vacant home tax in this city and we need it quickly.
All right, Matty McGrath, the rural towns are no strangers to vacant properties either. But some of the root cause of some of that is development on the edges of towns that have led to people getting, I don't mean residential properties, but these above shop units and the like, buildings have been abandoned because you've got development on the edge of towns.
Of course, I know a town, Tipperary, a very big town. There's only one resident living in the town. Many, many, many shops have closed. So Jennifer's right, you can't quantify. It might be some reason for a vacant property where a person is a nursing home and there's probate issues, whatever. Maybe that could delay. But when you look at the vacant shops, and turn them into, and we've been promised this several times, incentives to turn those places back into a living area. You do two things. You'll have a living town back with people living in it. And you'll also fight dereliction and you'll take an awful lot of people off the housing list. So we must be imaginative here. And this doesn't take an awful lot of imagination to try and regenerate our towns and villages, every one of them.
One of those issues about the shops that was covered in the report that was released yesterday was some of the barriers to bringing them into use is the regulation, things like fire regulations and things like disability regulations. In fact, a listener has just texted in to say, hi, can you ask, are they going to build two-bed bungalows for older people, not apartments, as I won't be able for the stairs. Please ask your panel. I live in a three-bed home. I need a small home, says Teresa. So,
and they should be able to skate. They should be able to downsize and there should be incentives as well. People in nursing homes should have incentives to let the house could be closed up, let them back into the market but do proper incentives. Not all of what the construction industry want. I mean, they seem to be dictating the policy at the moment and I thought we have it's a sense of deja vu. We had enough of that before.
And do you support a vacant
I do at this stage, yes, certainly. Yeah. I don't like the more taxes, but look, I mean, certainly we need to do similar. No, I'm saying I'm pro-development as well, but I'm just saying we need to get these properties, whether they be shops, whether they be closed restaurants, whether they be whatever, we need to get them into functioning places for people to live. And you'll fight dereliction as well there. But we need to get rid of we need to raise incentives for the business people. We need tax breaks as well for them to develop them. Not developers, for the people who own them or for people to want to buy them and do them up themselves at affordable prices.
That's called development.
I know it is. What are you business man? I know what it is.
All right. Gary Gannon, the Irish Independent.
You don't have to be consumed by developers altogether, Paul.
The Irish Independent reporting today that the Department of Education is objecting to development. Three large-scale housing developments in Cork and South County Dublin, 1,700 new homes there, another over 1,000 in North Dublin as well.
Do you know what it made me think of? I find it very strange. But each week the Taoiseach sits in the Dáil during this Punch and Judy session that happens between Sinn Féin and the government. And the Taoiseach accuses opposition TDs of opposing developments in their area. And I say, it must be very embarrassing then for the Cabinet or for the Taoiseach to sit around and go, well, actually, departments in his own government are now opposing developments. The fact that we don't have enough skill places is a reason to build more skills. It's the reason to be more innovative with classrooms. It's not a reason to oppose development. So I think the Taoiseach...
But if land that was zoned for a school is the planning permission is now being sought to build apartments on that same land, then the Department of Education is pointing out that the room won't be there for a school if that goes ahead in that form.
Yeah, but I mean, in terms of we can also, a lot of our skills that we have at the moment, particularly in urban areas, they're quite antiquated and they need development. As we're redeveloping them, we can add more spaces onto those skills because some of our skills, as we found out during COVID, are simply not fit for purpose. So we need to be looking at redeveloping them, making them bigger if necessary. But that's not be be opposing development. So Taoiseach needs to get in front of this. I think it would be an embarrassing day for his government today when that was announced.
Were you surprised by that, Paul McAuliffe, to see the Department of Education objecting?
Well, the idea that the planning process is to take views from different people when the planners make an independent decision.
How much weight does the Department of Education carry?
Well, I imagine the same makes the same weight as Irish Water as a local authority. The planners, whether it's a local authority or in Port Pinola, make that balanced decision. So I'm not going to say that anybody doesn't have a right to contribute. I actually think everybody should contribute in a local planning matter. The more important thing is what you say, that there are sites available in overall developments. I think the SHD process, for example, and I'm really pleased that we were able to bring that to an end, didn't take into account many of those local issues that local authorities previously would have. So I think it's important that as we plan communities that are sustainable, because Gary will tell you, like communities in the past, big public local authority housing, it wasn't that the public housing was the problem, is that community facilities weren't in place. So as I say, I don't have a problem with the department submitting a planning application. And I go back to the point, there are houses being planned and built, and that is because of government policy.
Matty, in rural communities, the school has been seen as part of the heart of it, along with post offices,
yes,
and pubs and other facilities as well. And people have been very reluctant to let go of smaller, yes, schools. So would you have some sympathy for the Department of Education in making this point?
Not really, because we already have a problem with every rural village, and I'm sorry, not every, but most of them in rural Ireland, in my county and every other county, where you don't have the infrastructure by Irish Water. So if Johnny, Joe Bloggs wants to build a house, he can't because there's no capacity. If a developer wants to build a scheme of 15 houses, he can't, there's no capacity. Now if we're going to have the heavy arm of education also stopping, there's ample land in most rural towns. In Tipperary, one of the biggest landowners, vacant property owners are the county councillors, so there's lots of property. So I don't want another overreaching. We already have the planning, Office of the Planning Regulator. I have at least 20 young couples in County Tipperary that have their own sites, can get a site at home, are able to get the mortgage, or were before this massive increase, and won't get planning in the houses. So that's,
you can't blame the Department of Education.
No. I'm saying, but the Department of Education to come in now is that objecting. I can't believe it. I mean, and I would pick up something that Paul said, because Port Pinola, look, I've seen countless episodes of where the inspector comes out and he's sides with the county council on a decision or the other way, and the board overturned the inspector's decision. It's happening nearly more than 50% of the time, so something very funny going on there as well.
Right, well, you may disagree with it, but they have their job to do. Well, we're going to take a break now. You've done the first rebrand of the night that we made the call out for at the beginning, changing Cree Conaghan to Cree Briseadh. We've had a couple of other suggestions in on other rebrands. The Workplace Relations Commission becomes the Workplace Divorce Commission. Seems more accurate, says David Fox on Twitter. Rob Cullen, 79, says RT Fee. The Late Late Show is on at 9:30. Somebody calling for a rebrand there. And somebody says that it's time. The time has passed. We should rename New Grange to Old Grange. We'll be back possibly with more of your suggestions after the break.
The Late Debate on RTE Radio 1. The Late Debate on RTE Radio 1.
All right, you can contact us on 51551 latedebate@rte.ie or at latedebate.rte on Twitter. A few more of those rebrands. C. McCulloch suggests and learnings to be officially added to the end of all government department titles to the minister's official title, i.e. the minister for XYZ and learnings. Somebody else suggesting, Suzanne McGilligan, saying Dublin Airport should be Dublin Stayport. And the leaving certificate, says Anne Lowney, should be changed to not the be-all and end-all certificate. So people who have done the leaving cert, speaking of education and the Department of Education we were talking about before the break, the area of skills as we come into the tourist season, Jennifer, we've heard from vintners and people in the hospitality sector saying they're crying out for people, chefs, bar staff, who can work and staff all of the premises that are there. Otherwise, they're going to have to shut down for a part of the year, as we heard in the media during the week, even shut down permanently because they don't have the staff to run the premises.
That's right. So there's good news and I suppose less good news. What we heard from the Oireachtas Tourism Committee. And the good news is that 93% of the Vintners Federation members have reopened after the pandemic. And we know how badly hit that sector was. One of the worst hit sectors, actually. And actually that sales are up between 90 to 110%. So that's the positive side. That's on 2019 levels. The knock-on effect is this bounce back has created and generally in terms of the shortage of workers, there is this shortage of skilled workers and crucially a shortage of accommodation spaces for workers, particularly in Dublin. And what the Committee on Tourism was told was that some pubs have been left with no choice but to operate on reduced hours or on fewer days of the week. Maybe they're shutting down on Mondays or Tuesdays. And I think they're looking for an enhanced package from the state. I think the point that some of the government TDs were making at the committee was, well, you know, you're back to 93% of premises opened. You're at 110% of
VAT is still at 9%.
Exactly, that has remained at that level. But I think what they'd say in counter to that was, well, there are dark clouds on the horizon, but things are good now. But all things being considered, there is a shortage of staff, and that's not just in that sector. That's across the entire hospitality sector.
And food comes at the same time as food inflation and everything else. The costs are rising for business people, which presumably at some point they're either going to have to pass on to the consumers or eat into their own profits, which makes the business less sustainable. So what's the answer, Matty McGrath? How do we get more staff into the hospitality sector, especially at the time of the tourist season?
We have an excellent centre in Atherstown and Tullis, and it's a solid runner. And I visited recently, and they're training every kind of apprenticeship from bed making in hotel rooms to literally heavy welding and plant and agriculture, plant and machinery. It's a fabulous. We need more apprenticeships, and we need to make sure the Leaving Cert isn't the be all of the university degrees. But I'm a bit perplexed about the Vintners, because I visit a lot of rural pubs and they're on their knees. There's no customers in there any night of the week, Friday nights even. So I don't know where this spin is coming from. Or is it the Dublin pub, Dublin Vintners?
That was the Vintners on the licence.
In Dublin?
The Vintners Federation.
Because the rural pubs, I mean...
Well, the Vintners Federation, just for the listeners, the Vintners Federation of Ireland are the rural pubs, the licensed Vintners Association are the Dublin pubs. And the people we're talking, were
there? They were both in there. They're both in the committee.
Yeah, but I'm perplexed, because I met them last week, the retiring man from the Republicans reunion, and the new chap. He told me the same thing. But I know what pubs are closing next week, and they're closing the weeks after, and it's because business. And staff is a big issue, certainly, but they don't have the income or turnover to pay the staff. And you're right about the food and the cost of everything else, the cost of the gas and the electricity is just tripled and quadrupled, and they can't, it's just not viable.
All right, Paul, a social partnership has been talked about again, where employers in the public and the private sector would sit around a table and get into wage agreements. Is a wage agreement one way to get people back into the hospitality sector if people perhaps don't feel it's worth their while and the hours are challenging as well? Is premium pay maybe in the hospitality sector?
I think social
sector
partnership for a long time after the crash was derided, and I actually think its value is being recognised now. It's one way of trying to tackle inflation, ensure workers are paid correctly, and tries to adjust those costs that government can control. I think that's a different issue than the issue of hospitality. Like hospitality, but across the whole economy, we were facing a skills shortage before COVID. And you do have to ask yourself the question, people were given alternatives. Many of them were forced to move to other industries because hospitality was closed. But the wages and conditions in the hospitality industry can be quite low. Yeah. They can be incredibly precarious. And where many other industries were able to hold on because of significant government supports, in some cases, for example, this unskilled staff were let go, but management staff were retained in hospitality. I know many hospitality businesses that did manage, using government supports, managed to hold on to their staff on the books, and they've fared better since the recovery.
Yeah, and I do agree to a point, and I hope you'll forgive me, your more rural listeners will forgive me if it focuses my attention to Dublin. But hospitality workers are experiencing the same crisis that we talk about in terms of the housing crisis. They're being forced out of the city in many ways, so we can't just look at a shortage of skills in the hospitality sector in Dublin. In order to solve it, we do need to increase pay. We need to look at housing conditions. We also need to look at the social protection system for a person going back into the hospitality sector.
If you increase the cost for businesses, though, in terms of wages, that'll be ultimately passed on to the consumer. And private businesses in the hospitality sector are dependent on consumer footfall. So how do you strike the balance between the two of them?
Same people that we pay more also spend in that economy too when it comes back around in different ways. But there are other ways too. Also, if you look at the area of social protection, a person going back into the hospitality sector on low pay may actually lose their medical card entitlement. If a student is only allowed to do a particular amount of hours before they lose their back their education allowance, there's a number of different things we can actually do in terms of stimulating getting people back into work, and the government and the state can take responsibility for that.
Jennifer, one of the suggestions that was being made today was that maybe some of the newly arrived Ukrainian people who've come into the country could be integrated into the hospitality sector. But one of the things that jumps out at you from that suggestion is that an awful lot of the people arriving here are lone parents because there was a prohibition on fighting age males leaving Ukraine. So there's a childcare issue if people are to be integrated in, following on from what Gary was saying.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a childcare issue there. And, you know, I thought it was interesting questions have been asked in the Dáil, particularly about how to link up Ukrainian refugees who are coming in to employment. And I think when TDs have asked that question, they're kind of constantly told, well, there are supports and places locally in terms of intro centres. It would strike me maybe as a better idea that there was a more kind of centralised structure whereby there are people, you know, one agency may be dedicated to matching people up to jobs, because these jobs are clearly out there. And if there is an issue there in terms of ancillary supports like childcare or transport or accommodation or whatever it may be, then wouldn't it just make sense to have perhaps a body that is dedicated to it beyond intro or the social protection structures that are already there, dealing with many other applications for many other things.
And I also want to say, I think it's important to say, I don't just want to see refugees coming here, be from Ukraine or elsewhere, and be told that you should go into a low-wage economy. The same situations will still arrive in terms of the cost of living.
Well, there's actually a listener has got in touch to say restaurants want cheap labour from abroad. Government and unions must not give in. So somebody there is concerned about a race to the bottom and people being exploited in that sector.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. I don't want to cast aspersions upon the sector at all, but there are people who are engaged in it can't afford the rent in this city. They're not being paid a wage that takes them out of poverty in many instances. So the Lloyds and Vintners Association and other associations, in order to represent the industry and get it thriving again, they need to look at all the issues that are impacting the members and lobby from a multitude of different fronts, I believe.
And it's about valuing the profession as well. And that's to do with, and I know Collins and Simon Harris have put in place modern apprenticeships, and the ETB is involved, but it is about valuing it as a profession. These aren't just labour that are lumped in and lumped out of when demand comes and goes.
Marty. I know Gary said that he doesn't want to go across. I mean, the rural issue, but there's no rural transport, there's no public transport.
Well, in fact, what Gary is saying is that the urban workers are becoming rural dwellers.
And the point I'm trying to make, the rural dwellers who are travelling 10 or 20 miles to work have to sleep now in hostelries just because they can't afford to travel back and forward. It's a very, very slippery slope, and I don't want it to go down any further either, because we need, and you can't just say we'll expect the Ukrainian refugees to fill the gap. That's not the answer. Many of them are highly skilled, and their skills should be used in roles that they have and be respected for the roles that they have as well.
We also have to be sensitive. Like, it's 91 days since Russia invaded Ukraine. These people are not the solution to our labour crisis. These people are here because we're protecting them, because they're fleeing a war. And I think we just have to be sensitive to that.
I think on the macro level of support for Ukraine, Jennifer, Ireland supports Ukraine's pathway into the EU. There's some debate about that. It's a hot topic in Europe, because on the one hand, people want to see Ukraine facing westwards. On the other hand, there are people in the queue in the Western Balkans. Bosnia, Serbia, Macedonia, Albania, all of these countries have been aspiring for quite a long time and meeting EU criteria to get in. So the idea of Ukraine, as they would see it, jumping the queue isn't going down too well there. And there is a sort of a cautious message from Europe saying, we support your bid, but only in order of preference and meeting the conditions. Where does Ireland stand on it?
I think Ireland has been very supportive of Ukraine's bid to join the EU. I think the issue that it comes down to is whether there's a fast track process there, which I think you're referring to. And at the European Affairs Committee today, Ivana Klimpisch-Sinsad, and apologies if I mispronounce that name, she was basically saying, and she is chairwoman of the Committee of European Affairs in the Ukrainian Parliament, And she was thanking Ireland for their for the country's support in terms of that application to join the EU. But she also mentioned several countries that she felt were not supportive. And I think she mentioned France, Germany and the Netherlands. And it, what it will come down to, I think, is this issue of the fast track procedure. And the argument that will be made by Ukrainian politicians is that this is a different situation to the other regions that you mentioned specifically, and that, as Paul said, they're 91 days into this war and thousands of people are dying, you know, and the urgency is there now. But I think there is real resistance across the entire bloc to how to go about that. And even though we are supportive of that, it's hard to see kind of where that will land in the next few months.
Right, Gary, Bosnia are less than 30 years after they are, around 30 years after the genocide that occurred there. Yes. They've waited in line. Yeah. They have issues there with Russian interference in their politics and the secession of Republic of Serbia.
There's also Moldova and Georgia who share land borders with Russia, and Georgia has a Russian occupation going on at the moment, and they're saying if we're fast-tracking Ukrainian, which I believe we should, what about us too? We're going to.
Do you think they should get in quicker than the countries in the Western Balkans?
I think the EU, when it's at its best, it's a peace process. It's a peace project that brings people in as a way of kind of alleviating future conflict. There's very clearly strength in numbers in that regard. I think we should be fast-tracking the applications of the Ukraine, but we should do it in a way that's supportive but also realistic. Moldova, Georgia are going to have the exact same probably justifications to be fast-tracked also.
And you think that when you say fast-track, where are you putting them in order? You're saying Moldova, Georgia and Ukraine should be put ahead of the countries in the Western Balkans?
I don't really have a ranking system at the moment for that, but I do think in terms of the situation that's been experienced, the precarious situation that's been experienced by Moldova, Georgia, and also the horrors being inflicted upon Ukraine, there is an argument that bringing Ukraine without those two other countries in will just move the problem over.
And Paul McAuliffe, what about the French suggestion that you could have a sort of a pre-European status, pre-European Union status that Ukraine could possibly join along with other countries where, as they fulfilled the accession criteria, maybe after that they could be left in, but that the rules must be fulfilled first.
Yeah, I can understand the caution that a number of countries are bringing to it. Like, Europe means something. It'll only continue to mean something if we don't dilute it. And therefore, countries do have to reach certain criteria. They have to have democratic norms. They have to have economic guarantees. So we can't just allow anybody to enter. Mm-hmm. They have to reach a bar. And I wouldn't rank them by country. I'd rank them by achievement of reaching those bars. And the quicker a country can achieve them, then that should be what drives it. That idea of a French system, I think, is a way of creating a sphere of influence. Sounds a bit of an imperial concept to me, and I wouldn't necessarily be a fan of it. We do also have to think that if Ukraine becomes a member of the European Union are effectively in a position where they are at war with Russia. And that's something that we need to consider. But I do favour Ukraine's membership, but only if they reach all of the criteria that was presented to them.
So people who are further along the road of meeting those criteria should get in before. Yeah,
European expansion is always controversial because it dilutes power, it changes power balances. But as a project, if you can meet the criteria and you're part of the peace project, it's important. We've seen where Poland and Hungary and some countries have diluted European values, and we have to be careful of that.
Marty?
Yeah, I do agree with Gary. I think that we'll have to look at this very, very carefully and sensitively, because if there are countries, and there are, that are in a pecking order, so we can't just, and remember when the horrific genocide in Bosnia-Herzegovina and Yugoslavia at the time, so we must also remember that they're there as well, so we have to be very careful. So I would give some merit to the French idea, without having studied it, that we have maybe a ranking system that they would be a position rather than the full membership, because it's going to cause huge angst if they jump the queue completely and are accepted in with open arms, which we should, I suppose, but I'm just making the point that we need to be level-handed here and even-handed and respect the other countries that are in the queue as well.
Right. The war in Ukraine is something that influenced a statement recently by the Rural Independent Group. You're looking to drill offshore for oil and for the sake of Ireland's energy self-sufficiency?
Yes, of course I am. Because we're getting it from all kinds of oil, from Russia and different places, which are very shady. So there's 365 million barrels of oil in the Ballyroe field. And this is an emergency, because you have to keep the lights on here. And I'm all for renewables. I'm all for the wind energies, but they're not coming on stream fast enough. So this is a resource that's there. It's an emergency. It's a war situation. People tell me that oil could be priced next year. Sorry?
What about nuclear?
Yeah, it was considered as well. But this is sitting on our coast here, and just because of ideological reasons, it shouldn't be closed and capped. We need to reopen it, right. Get that oil flowing.
It's not going to happen anytime soon.
The lights are out, it might happen very fast.
But when would you expect to find this oil and gas?
It's there. It has been there in the past. It's there.
Right, and it's just a matter
it's
of turning on the
tap. Fundamental ideology that want to stop fracking and gas exploration.
All right, Paul.
It's there in vast quantities.
Colm, with 3 minutes left, I'm not going to change Matty McGrath's view on climate change, but there are some politicians that want to give people easy answers, and there are other politicians that are climate brave. Okay. And I'll be saying to people in the public, elect politicians that are climate brave, because it's about the planet.
Now, under no circumstances we engage in any more fossil fuel extractions. I mean, there is a number of crises impacting the planet. And, we have 12 years in order to save, actually not even 12 years anymore, in order to stave off a climate catastrophe. That's actually science. We've less than 12 years to stave off climate catastrophe. We can't be engaging in any more fossil fuel extraction.
I'm just saying that we'll engage very fast if the lights are out.
Jennifer, even if the government were to open their ears and their heart to Matty's suggestion, it'd be more Greens overboard, wouldn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I think there's no doubt about that. I mean, the government banned new oil and natural gas exploration, and I don't see any move to go back on that. Though I fully take on board Maddie's point. I mean, I definitely would have picked up, even as a journalist, a complete lack of information about our future energy supply, particularly in terms of the crisis with Russia. And I personally would love to know more about how we're going to future-proof against that, personally.
Yeah, and I also don't think it's a case of we're not dealing with Russia anymore, so now we go over and deal with other oligarchs, and so we're not taking oil from Russia now, so we go over to Colombia and see the impact that have on communities all the way over.
I agree.
The future of our independence lies in offshore wind. That's why the Marine Area Planning Bill has gone through.
The question is when?
10 years' time. Quickly?
Well, actually, all the technology isn't even in place for us to do it, but Ireland has the potential actually to be an energy exporter.
It's sitting there.
But it is collaboration around the EU level as well in terms of wind, solar, potentially even
waves. The oil has been sitting there for millions of years.
The lights are out, you'll be changing your tune.
Okay, well, but back to our rebranding competition. Somebody else suggesting that turf should be rebranded. No, new turf, just don't tell Eamon Ryan on the subject of fossil fuels. Jerry Bridgette says EDs, emergency departments, should be named waiting for Godot departments. But I think Old Grange is probably leading the polls tonight. And thanks very much. That's all from us tonight on Late Debate, or as our politicians probably rebranded it already, Detention. The programme was produced by Brian Lally, researched by Andrew Fleming. The broadcast coordinator was Shane Galvin, and Harry Buckless was on sound. Stay tuned for Cathal Murray with The Late Date. But first, we'll hand over to Michael Corcoran on the Sports Desk.